More formally now, good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Of course, you can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club, and will be moderating today's discussion. It is my very great pleasure to welcome our special guest today, who has a very special relationship with the Commonwealth Club. She's a former board member at the club and my very good friend, Dr. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, Deputy Energy Secretary. Dr. Sherwood Randall is a California native, lived in the Bay Area for a number of years, grew up in Southern California. She has served as second in command at the U.S. Department of Energy since October of 2014. She joined the Obama administration on day one, serving from 2009 to 2013 as a special assistant to the president and senior director for European affairs at the National Security Council. In 2013 and 2014, she served as White House coordinator for defense policy, countering weapons of mass destruction and working on arms control efforts. Before she joined the president's team, Dr. Sherwood Randall worked at Stanford University, Harvard University, and the Council on Foreign Relations. In the Clinton administration, where she and I were very happy colleagues, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. That was from 1994 to 1996. She attended college at Harvard University, went on to graduate school at Oxford University, where she was among the early ranks of female Rhodes Scholars. She began her foreign policy career working for then-Senator Joe Biden as his chief advisor on foreign and defense policy. So it gives me very great pleasure to welcome back our good friend, Dr. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall.
Thank you, Gloria. It's so wonderful to be here. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Club, George Dobbins, who I worked with so closely when I was here serving on the Board of Governors, you and Greg Dalton as well, for giving me this opportunity to talk today here. I have such wonderful memories of our service together at the Pentagon. We worked then under Defense Secretary Bill Perry, who was a visionary leader, and gave us the shared mission of reducing the lethal legacy of the Cold War. And that was a very meaningful opportunity for us to serve our country. And after that, we both came to the Bay Area, where I had the honor to join your Board of Governors, as you have led this organization, which is evidently thriving. And I know that you are now building a new building for this club, and you are continuing to perform this extremely important a role of providing a venue for the discussion of the issues of our day in a space that enables civil discourse, which I have to say is in very short supply in Washington. So I'm thankful to be in an environment like this for once. Gloria, you, by my count, are coming up on 20 years of leadership, and this community has been so fortunate to benefit from that leadership. And the building of this new building is yet another example of what you're doing as a lasting legacy here. So I want to express my gratitude to you for your extraordinary service to our nation, to the Bay Area, and your wonderful friendship as well. Today I asked if I could have the opportunity to talk about resilience in the energy sector, because this has emerged as a new and vitally important mission for our Department of Energy on behalf of the American people. This is frankly something that most people don't think anything about. They don't think about it because they go about their lives and just generally expect the lights to come on, the heat or the air conditioning to work, all their gadgets to be powered whenever they want to charge them, wherever they need to charge them, and they really don't think very much about what it takes to make that happen. But we are facing now a combination of natural and man-made threats that put all of this that we expect at risk. Severe weather, natural disasters, aging equipment, and the effects of climate change threaten our energy infrastructure. You know this well here in California, from fires to earthquakes and drought conditions, which are impacting generation, transmission, and distribution. In addition, intentional, deliberate challenges to our energy infrastructure are on the rise, including from those who have malicious intent who want to disable our way of life through physical or cyber attacks or some combination thereof. For example, living here in the Bay Area, many of you will recall that there was an attack on a substation, the Metcalf substation, in 2013, which was a wake-up call for a lot of people about the vulnerability of our energy infrastructure. So building on that national security background that Gloria described to you, I've made it one of my top priorities as Deputy Secretary to work on strengthening the resilience of our electricity infrastructure and more broadly our energy grid. And the reason for this priority is simple. As President Obama has pointed out, energy and communications systems enable all other infrastructures in our nation to function. He's observed that if we don't protect the energy sector, we're putting every other sector of our economy in peril. We at the Department of Energy are, by presidential directive, the day-to-day coordinator with the energy sector on matters of security, resilience, incident response, and planning. In government speak, we're called the sector-specific agency for the energy sector. So I thought today I would describe to you three dimensions of our work to fulfill those responsibilities, since many don't know about the role of the federal government in this space. First, we partner with industry. Second, we support innovation at our national laboratory network and with the private sector. And third, we exercise our capabilities so that we can test our planning and practice our responses before emergencies happen. So, on partnering with industry, here is a remarkable fact that I learned when I became Deputy Secretary a year ago. The vast majority of our nation's energy infrastructure, the networks of pipelines and our electric grid, is owned and operated by private companies, utilities, and co-ops. In fact, 90% of the electricity infrastructure is in private hands. So that means that we in the government can't do this job alone. We must partner with the private sector to achieve our goals of implementation, of prevention and response, so that we can ensure rapid recovery if prevention fails. Our primary means for aligning and coordinating with the private sector toward these goals is through something that are called the Sector-Specific Coordinating Councils, or SCCs. These are self-organized councils that enable critical infrastructure owners and operators, their trade associations and others, to interact with the government and serve as an entry point to collaborate with the government on security and resilience issues. That's trying to find a way to go across that public-private divide that can often be a barrier to effective cooperation. A great success story of SCCs is the Electricity Subsector Coordinating Council. This is a group of 30 leaders from across the electricity sector, including 21 major utility CEOs, who meet three times a year to coordinate how we will work as a team to prepare for and respond to national-level disasters or threats to critical infrastructure, including cybersecurity. From California, I'd note that PG&E, based here in the Bay Area, participates in this endeavor, as do trade associations representing public power, like the City of San Francisco Utility Commission and rural electric cooperatives. The ESCC is a model for how industry and government can and should be working together. I've worked closely with these CEOs to identify and promote best practices that energy companies can use, regardless of their size, to protect their systems. The two most notable efforts in this area in cybersecurity include the Obama administration's cybersecurity framework and the cybersecurity capability maturity model, or what we call C2M2. The cybersecurity framework is a voluntary guide for the critical infrastructure community. It was the result of a year-long public-private collaborative effort led by the National Institute of Standards to establish guidance for how to protect infrastructure from cyber attacks. Our department built on that work and developed implementation guidelines for industry to assist the energy sector, again serving as a model for other sectors. In addition, C2M2 helps utility companies gain a comprehensive understanding of their existing cybersecurity capabilities and their needs going forward in a very dynamic threat environment. This enables them to make informed decisions about the cybersecurity investments they need to make and helps us at DOE know how we can partner more effectively with them to raise our collective game. In addition, with our industry partners, we're trying to figure out how we can tackle the critical challenge of the need for speed. In such a dynamic threat environment, and one that's moving at digital speed, it takes way too long for us to share information about threats. And if we don't share it quickly enough, we'll fail to protect our nation. Our solution is to generate the tools and information that we can transmit to companies so that they can become aware of risks as soon as they have identified them and take action. And in reverse, we need information from them about threats that they identify on their networks. In 2013, we launched the Cybersecurity Risk Information Sharing Program, or CRISP. This program is providing the capability for government and industry to exchange and analyze cyber threat data so we can understand what's happening and figure out what to do about it quickly. 20 companies from across the electricity sector are currently participating in CRISP, and we're working to increase that number. The goal for us is to be able to share information in real time. We're not there yet because we need to build the capabilities to exchange it and overcome the firewalls between the public and private sector, but we're working toward in that direction. I mentioned that the second way in which we're working to advance our resilience goals is in supporting innovation. Many people don't know that the Department of Energy is responsible for 17 national laboratories spread all around this country that are really jewels in our crown of technological and scientific innovation. These are amazing engines of discovery, and some of them grow out of the origins of the Department of Energy, which is the Manhattan Project. You have 4 of these labs in the Bay Area: the Livermore National Lab, the Berkeley National Lab, Sandia National Lab West, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator. No wonder this place is the heartbeat of American innovation. Their science and technology research is helping us to expand the state of the art in clean energy technologies and helps us to generate technical solutions that enable us to make the electrical grid more resilient. For example, in one current project, our Sandia National Lab is partnering with the private sector to develop a commercial solution that prevents tampering with the kinds of field devices that you see attached to utility poles. Because these systems are out in the open, they can be an inviting target for hackers, especially as new systems offer more options for remote operations. As a partner in the Padlock Security Gateway project, Sandia helped to invent a new way for these systems to sense physical tampering and signal operators that something is wrong. Our national labs are also powerful partners working with industry on securing industrial control systems. At our Idaho National Lab, we have an 890-square mile test bed, including a critical infrastructure test range complex, where we have miles and miles of electric distribution infrastructure, poles, wires, transformers, and control systems, where we conduct extensive testing with industry. We also have a wireless national user facility there, so we can study and learn about networked attacks and learn how to prevent, mitigate, and respond to them. Lawrence Livermore Lab is also a key player in the California Energy Systems in the 21st Century program. This is a great example of developing creative partnerships to drive innovation in grid security. It's a collaborative public-private research and development project between 3 California utilities and Livermore Lab to enhance grid security and flexibility. And it is working on developing automated response systems to respond to cyber attacks. PG&E, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric are the utility partners in this project, and it was directed by the California Public Utilities Commission and the California State Legislature. Going forward, we need to bring to bear this innovative spirit that has kept our nation on the cutting edge for centuries. So we're exploring innovative funding mechanisms as well for public-private partnerships to advance transformational technologies. To that end, I've initiated a dialogue among experts from the electricity subsector, the information technology sector, the DOE National Labs, and the investment community to increase understanding of the priority needs for innovation and investment in cybersecurity. For example, Brent Stacy from our Idaho National Lab told Congress earlier this week that he and his team are pursuing a grand challenge to develop novel and deployable solutions to take a set of high-value infrastructure assets off the table as targets. DOE's current direct support and investment to smarter automated technologies on the grid is an example of what greater investment has already achieved in this domain. Since 2009, we've used $3.4 billion in stimulus funds to accelerate deployment of over 16 million smart meters, more than 9,000 automated switches, and more than 1,300 new sensors that help grid operators understand and control grid conditions with unprecedented accuracy and responsiveness. Where we've deployed advanced metering infrastructure networks and smart meters, we've seen reductions in operational costs of up to 50%. And we've seen faster recovery from power disruptions after weather events, which benefits all of our consumers. During a visit here last month, I sat down with Tony Earley, the PG&E CEO, who I know spoke here just last week. And he told me that during last summer's earthquake in Napa, 70,000 businesses and homes lost power. But because many of the affected businesses had smart meters, PG&E was able to quickly pinpoint these outages. As a result, they were able to restore power to customers within 24 hours, and to most customers within 24 hours, and to all customers within 36 hours. The point here is that we see that innovation pays off in so many ways, developing new ways of meeting threats and generating jobs and growth for our economy at the same time. So we're going to keep pushing forward to develop innovative solutions and do it in collaboration with those outside of government who are force multipliers in so many ways. Third, I said I'd talk about planning and exercises. This is another dimension of our work which I want to talk to you about, which is a federal responsibility, and that is what we do when a disaster actually strikes. We've learned a lot from recent disasters, especially in the wake of Superstorm Sandy in 2012. And deriving from that experience, a lot of work has been done to significantly improve the way in which we respond partnering with industry. We know that when a hurricane, earthquake, or cyber attack has knocked out power lines or other infrastructure, the American people expect us to restore power as quickly as possible. So what we need to do is do what is done in the American military. We need to exercise, first by developing a plan together, and then putting it to the test, and adjust that plan based on the lessons that we learn from that drill. Every time that I've exercised, I've learned that there are gaps and vulnerabilities that I'm very glad I learned about before the real thing happened. So, for example, earlier this year, I went down to Florida to participate in Florida Power and Light's annual hurricane exercise. That exercise was based on a major hurricane making landfall right on top of Miami. Next week, a couple of members of my team will be out at Southern California Edison, participating in a major exercise as well. And in a month, I'll lead the federal government exercise, the largest electricity sector crisis response exercise ever, called GridX3, which will include simulated cybersecurity threats to the electric grid and involve the private sector as well as state and local governments. These are a key part of our collaborative efforts, a test of the frameworks we create and whether they would actually be able to do the job for you in real time. They also give us a chance with industry and with state and local governments to walk in each other's shoes and really learn how we need to grow and improve together. I've actually called on us to expand these efforts because one of the things I discovered is that we were not exercising across sectors, and there are great interdependencies among us. We learned that out of Superstorm Sandy. So for example, the electricity sector needs to exercise with the oil and natural gas sector, because so many of our power plants are now being powered by natural gas, and we need to be sure that in an emergency, the natural gas can get to the power plants that need it. We also need to exercise with the transportation sector for the same reason, and with the communications sector to ensure that we know how to get the word out to people when the power is down and some of our normal methods of communication don't work. These systems, as I said, are highly interconnected and interdependent, and so we have to all work together to improve our resilience and response. So I'll just close by saying there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes to strengthen the resilience of our infrastructure, and a lot more that we have to do. We can certainly look at this as a glass half full or half empty. Lots of people see it as half empty and criticize us for not doing enough. I'll say that it's half full from my perspective because I'm proud of the work we're doing to bring solutions to the table that will help every American citizen to maximize the benefits of 21st century communications technologies while minimizing the risks of the associated and increasing connectivity that provides new threat vectors for those who would do us harm. I'll say that if I were young, I would, and I see a number of young people here today, I would choose this as a place to work. That is, I'd want to put my mind to tackling some of these challenges at the forefront of inventing solutions to the problems we face at the intersection of climate change and the digital economy. It's hugely interesting, meaningful, and important work, and it will benefit future generations. Thank you very much for giving me the chance to speak with you today, and I look forward to the conversation that we're going to have.
Our thanks to Dr. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, Deputy U.S. Energy Secretary. So I'd like to start with a very broad question. You've mentioned a number of the projects you're involved in at the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy is a big federal agency, and some folks may not be fully aware of the range of things. What's the mission of the Department of Energy, and what is the range of responsibilities that it has?
So I'll start out by telling you a funny story. When I called my beloved mother, who lives in Southern California, to tell her that the president wanted to nominate me to be Deputy Secretary of Energy, my mother's response was, "Well, darling, I have no idea what the Department of Energy does, but you've always had a lot of energy, so I'm sure you'll be great at the job." And that reflects the fact that most people, she's a very informed citizen, she listens to Commonwealth Club programs, most people have no idea what DOE does. So I will tell you that we have a huge range of responsibilities. We have 15,000 federal workers and more than 100,000 contractors who work for us. And our mission grew out of the Manhattan Project. So first of all, we have responsibility for ensuring the safety, security, and reliability of the nuclear weapons that are in our arsenal. And we do that through our national laboratories, the nuclear security laboratories, as well as through a number of sites around the country that are responsible for ensuring that we have a nuclear deterrent without testing, because the Clinton administration, President Clinton, decided in the mid-90s, when you and I were serving, to forego testing of our nuclear weapons and to depend on science to determine whether we could rely on those nuclear weapons. And we have just celebrated 20 years of stockpile stewardship, which is an enormous scientific achievement by our lab. So that's what we grow out of, is the Manhattan Project. We also, through that work, have been able to be the science and technology brains behind all of our counterproliferation work around the world, something, Gloria, you were intimately involved in the Clinton administration. And there, for example, you will have known that our Secretary of Energy was a key player in the negotiations on Iran's nuclear program that concluded this summer, in which we are just beginning to implement. And that was based on the science and technology work done in our labs, where we were able to generate options that could give our president confidence in the proposals we were putting on the table with regard to Iran's, the constraints on Iran's nuclear program. So that's the first piece, is nuclear security, both American security with our nuclear deterrent and also preventing proliferation around the world. The second element of our work is clean energy. So we have a vast array of work going on in these 17 labs in generating clean energy solutions. And we are working to both develop them and also deploy them through a number of programs with support from some of our the funding that came out of the Recovery Act and other initiatives to drive the deployment of clean energy solutions out into the American economy as well as around the world. Third, we have this resilience responsibility, which is a growing mission space for us. That is that we need to, as I was describing to you, keep the power on in the United States, working closely with industry. And many other duties, but I would say generally the science and technology piece on clean energy, the nuclear piece, and then the resilience and response piece are three key areas of work for the Department of Energy.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned working with the utility companies as partners. There's the security aspect of this work. I'm sure there's also work in terms of encouraging the reduction of greenhouse emissions in the ways that utilities generate energy. Could you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So actually today we published the Clean Power Plant rules, which were
put forth by the Environmental Protection Agency, but something that we were very much involved in doing the technological work in support of at DOE. So we do a lot of work in trying to, as I said, push out new technologies that can be used to reduce emissions. And a good example of that is the research we're doing on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. We know that coal is going to be used far out into the future, both in our own country and also especially in developing countries around the world that are just beginning to go up the development path, China, India, Brazil, and others, and which will require huge amounts of power in their futures. There are actually a billion people on this planet who don't have any access to electricity at all. So if you think of that as a statistic, we know that we need to figure out clean energy solutions. And one of the ways to do that is to make clean energy economically attractive, to make it good for business. So we're looking for ways that we can use emissions from these plants that generate CO2 to the benefit of the economy. Can it be captured and used in ways that will to desalinate water? Can it be used to extract more oil from an oil field? What are the ways in which CO2 can be beneficial economically in order to make the business case that it's worth the investment in CCUS technology? And many other things that we're doing to bring forward solutions. I would add we're also generating a huge array of new possibilities on the renewables front, which our utilities are increasingly excited about. And you certainly see that in California. On the point about clean energy being good for business, I'll just give one example, which is the work that's happened on the solar front. So in the beginning of the Obama administration, we took some of that RF funding and we invested it in solar. And we created something called the Sunshot Initiative. And we supported the establishment of the first 5 utility-scale solar power plants in this country. Now there are 21 utility-scale solar power plants, and they're all being funded by the private sector. This is one of the most dynamic sectors of our economy. There are more jobs in solar than there are in automobiles and light trucks combined in America today. And we see huge opportunities for the American people in this space. So what we're saying is this is good for the earth and good for the economy, and our utilities are signing up for it as well.
So looking back historically, in the early 70s, at the time of the oil embargo and the oil crisis, the Department of Energy instituted many new programs to promote renewable energy. There was the Solar Energy Research Institute that was set up in Colorado, a lot of effort to develop alternatives. As soon as oil prices went down again, it all went away. Then in recent years, there have been many new initiatives due to concerns about climate change as well as the price of oil. Do you think these initiatives have more staying power than the 1973 era efforts?
It's such a great question. First of all, I'll say one of the things we're seeing is the benefit of that research that was done. So we see across the lifespan of DOE, which was born in that period, that investments we made 2 decades ago are now paying off for the American people. So for example, our natural gas abundance grows out of research that DOE did 20 years ago. So we have to be investing now in things that will benefit the next generation or the generation beyond that. And we look at the cycles of the oil and gas industry. We know prices go up, prices go down. Yes, it's true they're down right now, but what we're trying to do is stimulate more research to develop the technologies that will benefit us when prices are back up again. And we are continuing to see the attractiveness of investment in these new technologies. So I don't foresee that this is going to fall off. And we also know, of course, because of the growing commitment around the world to the fight against climate change, there's greater interest in these technologies. I'll just add, we see 150 countries that have already set forth very significant commitments on the climate change front in advance of the negotiations that will take place in Paris in December. That accounts for more than 80% of the world's emissions. And so that's a good example of what I'm saying, that people are actually, unlike the period you're describing, conscious of the fact that we need to make this shift to clean energy solutions.
And I think the more widespread adoption, the partnership with utility companies, and the more widespread adoption in the economy by companies, in the investments that they're making, will make it more permanent. as opposed to the more research focus back in the early 70s. So one note for you and folks here, the Commonwealth Club's Climate One project will be attending the Paris Climate Summit as an observer and will be broadcasting back, interviewing the participants and broadcasting back here news from the Paris Climate Summit.
That is great. So I have to orient you towards something, and we'll tell Greg Dalton, who I know runs your Climate One program, about this. We are having an innovation day at the summit, and we're bringing, I think it's the 9th of December, and we're bringing lots of the examples of the work being done in DOE labs to showcase some of these innovative new technologies. So we need to get your people over there.
I will tell them right away. Yep. Thank you very much. There are a number of questions about the condition and age of the electrical grid. Please speak to the condition and age of the grid, current and repair and upkeep.
Thank you for asking that question. Our infrastructure is crumbling, and it's also vulnerable. So most of the infrastructure was built at a time when nobody was thinking about homeland threats. Our nation was defended against attack by our nuclear arsenal. People weren't worried about crazy people going and trying to harm an electricity substation. They were cited when there were no concerns about cyber threats. And much of the electricity infrastructure is way out in the middle of nowhere or in the middle of a city completely unprotected, and it's aging. We have made a very strong argument in this administration for investment in this infrastructure. We have, at DOE, done a lot of the analysis to support that, arguing that it is, again, good for the economy, good for resilience, meets our climate goals, because as we invest, we'll also modernize and we'll be able to use energy more efficiently at lower cost. And we have put forward to Congress a number of recommendations for investment in infrastructure. I have to say that not all of them have yet been embraced, but we continue to work to advocate for these investments because we need them going forward. And these are not things that happen in a day. It takes a long time to make this transformation, and it's necessary for our future.
A related question: we're facing a chronic underinvestment in infrastructure, both in the USA and abroad. In response, some countries are courting foreign investment to fill the gap. The UK has just secured billions from China for new nuclear plants. What are the risks and opportunities of foreign ownership of key national infrastructure?
It is a global economy, so we look, first of all, to take our capabilities around the world and to ensure that our businesses have the best opportunity to sell them around the world. We've just negotiated the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which will be a huge opening for American industry. I traveled in April with a delegation of 24 clean energy companies to China, because China has committed in work that we have done with them to significant effort on the climate front, and they need our technology. We have to protect our technology from an IP perspective, and that's work we have to advance, but we're looking to sell abroad. At the same time, companies look to sell here, and there's lots of benefit to investment in our economy and to the acquisition of some aspects of our infrastructure. There's also risk. And in the federal government, we actually have a process called the CFIUS process, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And I actually don't know who ordered it to be so, but the deputies in our government are the ultimate deciders on these issues of whether an investment threatens our national security. So quite frequently, I meet with counterparts across the administration to talk about whether a specific proposed investment creates a risk to us that is not acceptable. And in some cases, we deny an investment from a foreign country because we are concerned about what the capabilities are that would be obtained by that country, or the terrain in which they would base their operation and whether that might create a vulnerability for us. So I think you should feel confident that we are watching this closely. It's a continuing challenge because there's great interest in investing in our economy, but we also have a means of addressing it.
This is a relevant question in other sectors. Just a footnote, the Chinese are in a very strong position negotiating for the contract for the high-speed rail system in California. So it's also in the transportation sector because they bring financing with them?
They do often bring financing around the world. And it's one of the reasons it's so important that we strengthen our economy, because we want to stay competitive. And they don't have the same sets of rules and regulations governing how they do business that we do. And so, again, I'll go back to the TPP. It's one of the reasons it was so important to us to open up those markets to American businesses.
There are a few questions about climate change deniers. What is your department's response to climate change deniers?
We provide the facts, and the facts are
just the facts,
pretty indisputable.
Ma'am.
It's actually an exciting part of being at DOE is that we do bring the science to the table. We try to translate it in a way that non-scientists can understand it. Interestingly, there is more and more recognition, even among the deniers, that something is happening. I mean, if you go to Congress, these people represent communities that are being affected by climate change, by extreme weather events, and they have to recognize that things are happening that are damaging to our way of life and that we need to address it. So we are seeing increasing uptake. It's hard won. We will continue to have to push to persuade people, but I see a growing recognition that the facts are the facts.
You probably don't want to comment on specific companies or their activities in promoting climate change denial, but someone wants to know your thoughts on ExxonMobil's revelation that they have known of global warming since the 1980s, but have facilitated climate deniers ever since.
I think that's something I can't comment on, but I
I know you'll be trying to move them in the right direction.
I will say something very interesting, though, which is that in the work I'm doing with a number of the companies that I described in the Electricity Sector Coordinating Council, many companies are diversifying. So traditional energy companies are moving into the clean energy space, buying wind, buying solar, geothermal, all sorts of stuff, because they see that's the future. And so I think you're seeing even more traditional companies recognize that the world is moving on.
And engaging in disclosure, which is good. As you point out, the decisions we make today have results 20 years from now. With the Clean Power Plan, states will be making decisions on the infrastructure for types of energy, some cleaner than others. What is DOE doing to encourage and mandate clean energy, this person says, over natural gas, which harms our planet, during this fuel switching planning process with the states?
This is a big part of our responsibility at DOE, is to work with states on the development of their plans. So we provide what we call technical assistance, and that's literally expertise to states as they work through the question of how they're going to develop plans that will comply with these requirements. And that is dependent, again, upon the expertise of our national labs. We would like to do a lot more of that. This is an area in which we are also working with Congress to secure the funding to enable us to work across the states. If you look at a report that we published in April called the Quadrennial Energy Review, it's on our website. It has a whole section on working with states for clean energy solutions and resilience, and describes the work that we want to do going forward to support states. Because one of the things we see in this country, and it's really been striking to me in traveling around in this role, is how diverse the energy infrastructure is. Every state is different. It has a different mix of energy resources, different private sector arrangements, and there is no cookie cutter model for any state. So we have to develop these programs with each state to meet their requirements.
Since you brought up the Quadrennial Energy Review, could you describe the process within the Obama administration that set out the requirement for such a review, and then talk a little bit about the main points of the report from this review?
So the Quadrennial Energy Review was directed by President Obama, and the tasking to us was to look at energy transmission, storage, and distribution across this country, and to really think about the whole infrastructure that we currently have, and which one of you asked the question about, is it crumbling? Yes, it is. And the goal of this was to provide the technical analysis that would support the investments that need to be made in our infrastructure going forward in a transition to a clean energy and more resilient energy infrastructure. It drew on thousands of hours of work by our experts. It drew on multiple community discussions. We held many stakeholder meetings around the country. And if you're an energy nerd, it's really interesting to read. We followed it by a quadrennial technology review, which was rolled out in September, and it describes the game-changing technologies that we need to move toward, what the opportunities are for using technology to drive solutions in this space. So there are a series of reports we're producing, and we have also been asked to do a second QER, and so that will be coming up before the end of the administration.
Could you mention a few examples of the technologies that were pinpointed as being promising?
There are a whole range of them, and they involve work in cyber, for example, some of the things I was talking about in my remarks. They involve work in the solutions that will bring to bear greater efficiencies in the use of renewables. They involve some of the resilience efforts that we're looking to achieve. So it's a wide range, really an open-eyed look at the possibilities for the future in using technology to advance our clean energy goals.
What about the investment community? Since we lack investment in infrastructure, what about the financing and the investment sector as a sector with whom to work and to encourage?
This is an area of critical importance for us. And across the administration, there's been a big push to invite in the private sector to talk with us about partnership in driving clean energy solutions. And there was a summit on this at the White House recently. One of the interesting things we're seeing is that, especially coming from the Bay Area, there are a lot of investors who want to move into this space who have a somewhat different risk-reward calculus than a traditional investor. They're willing to take more risk because they're very interested in the public good, the benefit that will be derived from investing in clean energy solutions. And so we are working to build models of partnership. In fact, watch this space because there should be more of this coming as we go to COP21 of really working with the private sector to advance innovation. We also have had the opportunity to stimulate some of this by our loan programs initiative in the department. So we have been able to push out billions of dollars that came out of the Recovery Act funds in 2009 to stimulate work in clean energy solutions. And even earlier in the process, we have something called the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is designed to provide seed money for high-risk, potential high-reward innovation. So after the research has been done, to give people a chance to try to deploy it, it's so risky that most investors don't want to put money into it, but we've been able to see a big return on some of these investments in early deployment of technology, and now those are moving to market.
Reminding our listeners and viewers on the internet, the radio, television, you're listening to the broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, Deputy Secretary of Energy. If you had to identify the best utilities in terms of doing what they need to do to protect the grid, doing what they need to do to bring on sources of energy that reduce their carbon footprint, can you identify, say, a fast five around the country who really seem to get it and seem to be out there making progress?
I fear that our lawyers would tell me I'm not supposed to do that. Yeah. You have great utilities here in California. Okay. I've mentioned a couple of them. I mentioned I went to exercise with Florida Power and Light, which is doing innovative work. There are many, and again, back to that point about our most forward-looking energy companies and utilities really thinking about how to maximize the potential of renewables to be integrated into their electricity generation. They're seeing that as the future, and they see that it is good for their bottom line, good for their customers, also enhances their resilience. So for so many reasons, they're moving into that space, trying to figure out how to make it work. We have to figure out the model for this, and that's, again, work that's being done at a number of our labs, is to think through how to bring in renewables, because, of course, they are not constant. So we have to figure out how to store them, and there's new technology, battery storage, other kinds of storage. Some of it is working well, some of it less well. We're testing it and deploying it, trying to figure out what will be deployable at wide scale to enable us to bring renewables onto the grid in a way that will keep the grid stable.
More questions from the audience about the grid. We are moving toward a more networked, bi-directional grid as direct generation expands. Does this make it easier or harder to secure the grid from cyber attack, and how so?
Well, if you use the word to secure, I would say it probably makes it harder, but to be resilient, it may make it easier. So every deployment of technology that depends on our new capabilities in the digital space is a vulnerability. It enables communication in a way that is extraordinary, something that is revolutionary, transformational, but it also is a potential threat vector. And so as we move to distributed generation, you have more places where there can be the insertion of some kind of malicious threat. At the same time, having a distributed grid means we're able to isolate the source and protect the rest of it, so you have less dependence on the whole, and you can, if you can, back to what I was saying in my remarks, if you can actually quickly see where a threat has emerged, you can then isolate it and work around it. So that's beneficial. It also enables us to bring on more sources of power. So that means that if we lose one source because of a threat, there are others that are accessible. So we see it as ultimately a net strength, but we also have to anticipate where it creates new vulnerabilities and work to prevent or mitigate them.
How do you use your background in security to detect cyber threats before they happen, to predict cyber threats?
In general, my background in the national security space makes me very sensitive to the risks that we face across the nation and around the world from new capabilities. So that's the first thing I would say, is I'm very oriented toward the question, where are there emerging threats that we need to prepare to respond to, and then how can we defend ourselves better against them? Because those things happen at the same time. You have an emerging threat, you want to figure out how to respond, and also you want to prevent it from having an impact. And that has led me to a great deal of work, as I described it, with our labs and with the private sector to identify the requirements for solution generation. We're not there yet. I mean, this is very much a dynamic threat environment. And we don't have yet the capability which we're going to need to get to engineer in the solutions. Right now, much of what we have is solutions that we apply after the threat emerges. What we want to do is become much stronger against those threats. And that's work, for example, our Idaho National Lab that I mentioned is a critical contributor to that. Our Pacific Northwest National Lab, our Sandia National Lab are doing pioneering work in this field. And then, also as I noted in the remarks, exercising is critical. No amount of planning in theory can enable us to be effective. We have to actually test what we develop. And so I really push hard, and this comes very much from our experience working in the Department of Defense, Gloria, and then my work at the White House. The necessity to test in what is essentially a real-world situation. You actually have to be in role. You have to pretend. You have to get in the mindset that you're actually in a crisis. And the more real it is made to you, the more you reveal the vulnerabilities. And so we conduct these exercises. They're very expensive. They take a lot of time to prepare. We invest our leadership time in them, and then afterward we do hot washes to see what the lessons learned were and then apply them. And very, very important to do that going forward, to test our capabilities and to do it in an integrated way. So it means testing cyber in a context of potential physical attack or natural disaster. So what do you do if you're dependent on a capability in one dimension and you have a threat in another? What if there's a threat against both simultaneously? Often people fail to do that. They only test for one dimension. And when things happen, they tend to happen, unfortunately, involving multiple dimensions. And so then you're not prepared because you only tested in one and you didn't anticipate that vulnerabilities in another would cause you trouble. So for example, in the in a hurricane exercise I participated in, there was an expectation of being able to participate, communicate with the public about risks associated with certain developments, But the communications system in the exercise, correctly, had gone down, and people's cell phones didn't work. We couldn't communicate digitally. That had been the expected mode to communicate. So you have to figure out, well, what are we going to do if we don't have these capabilities? If you actually can't use the devices that people expect to use, and on and on.
I'm sure you've seen the movie San Andreas, in which that was part of the plot. But anyway, let's talk about nuclear power for a second. Nuclear power's history has been very up and down. So it was seen up until the 70s as a path to energy independence. Then we had the Three Mile Island incident, and there were safety concerns. Then in the early period of concern about climate change, nuclear power's presumed viability and importance shot up again. Then we had Fukushima Daiichi, and it went down again. What is your department's attitude at this point about nuclear power? What appropriate role should it play in our energy menu?
The strategy of the administration is what President Obama calls the all of the above energy strategy, and that has included a renewed commitment to nuclear power as an important source of non-fossil energy supply in this country. And so we at DOE have actually funded the first new nuclear power plant built in 30 years in this country. And we're also working very hard to develop new technologies that would enable us to deploy nuclear power in what are called small modular reactors. And that is, we believe, would be safer and more easily siteable because the footprint will be smaller, and contribute to our power generation both here and around the world with a non-fossil source. I will add, Gloria, that I just came back from Fukushima Daiichi. I was there last week. DOE has been involved since the immediate aftermath of this crisis, so that the president directed all resources be deployed to support our allies in Japan. The American military played a hugely important humanitarian relief role, and our experts came immediately, stayed on the ground with the Japanese, and have continued to work with the Japanese to help them to figure out how to recover from this catastrophe. It is truly one of the most stunning things I have ever seen in my life, to go to this place where four nuclear reactors were extremely damaged as a consequence of the earthquake, subsequent tsunami, and then the meltdowns in their cores. And it is a decadal responsibility to clean up, and a heroic task for the human beings who work there. And what we are doing in the collaboration with the Japanese is both helping them and learning from it to ensure that at home and around the world, the lessons of Fukushima Daiichi are applied so that no other nation ever experiences a catastrophe on that scale.
In general, with regard to advanced technology and energy generation, what avenues is DOE pursuing? One person wants to know about the status of fusion research.
So we're trying to push out the boundaries in every dimension. And these labs that we have are not ordered by us to do things. So it's an important thing. And it's very hard to explain to people that we give them broad guidelines for mission, but we want to let scientists imagine. Because when scientists imagine, they come up with innovative solutions. And we can't regulate every single thing they do. That crushes the inspiration that leads them to new discoveries. And so it's a delicate balance. We have management responsibility for this lab network, but we have to give them the freedom to run. And so we say to them, you know, work on solutions and come back to us and report on them, but not constrain them so much that it inhibits that invention and collaboration that's required. We are working on fusion. We have a number of labs involved in that, our Princeton National Lab, for example, Oak Ridge National Lab, and we're supporting, as an international endeavor, the big project in France at ITER, which is a very significant undertaking to try to achieve this holy grail of fusion. It's faced a lot of management challenges, and we're trying to work through them with our international partners. But in general, we're trying in every way to push out the boundaries of knowledge and invent new solutions that will bring power to those billion people who need it on this planet in a way that doesn't contribute further to the damage of the planet through climate change.
What's the expectation out of the Paris Climate Summit? Does our administration have a set of goals and wishes?
So we just got a report from the negotiators who were in Bonn before I came in here this morning. And we're in the end game of the negotiations. There's always a lot of puts and takes, and people take things down to the wire, but already we've achieved so much. So here's what I would say. The biggest thing we got done in preparation for COP21 was that we persuaded the Chinese to join with us in setting really ambitious targets. So we and the Chinese are the world's largest economies and largest emitters of CO2. And the president went to China last winter, and in that summit meeting, he and President Xi announced historic goals to combat climate change. And what we had that did was set essentially a competition among countries to be part of that party, so to speak. That is to also be seen to be among leading economies that were setting ambitious goals. The Indians subsequently set ambitious goals. And we now have 150 countries that have set individual goals, national commitments that they have made, which they're bringing to COP21. And I think I misspoke. I said 80% of the emissions. It's actually 90% of the emissions worldwide are accounted for by those commitments that have been made. So we expect that this will be a successful climate change conference. However, that is not the end of the story. So there is a road to Paris that we're on, where all the leaders will meet in early December, and there's also a road beyond Paris that we have to be on. And we have to drive hard and fast on that road beyond Paris, because there is a need for the kind of innovation that we've been talking about to develop and deploy at lower cost these clean energy solutions for countries around the world that will continue to develop, as well as industrialized countries that continue to use power as we do. And to that end, I would say we cannot pause. We actually have to work harder. There's a really interesting interview with President Obama in Rolling Stone magazine this month. It's not a place you usually see a president on the cover, but he was up in Alaska in August, so really truly moved by what he saw in Alaska, by the impacts of climate change there. And he was interviewed, and it's a fascinating interview in which he talks about how he has balanced his ideal of what he wanted to get done with the reality of what could be achieved in his administration, and how he sees the road beyond Paris. It's really worth reading, because it gives you a sense of how, as a leader, you have to be both a visionary, a dreamer, but you also have to be realistic about what you can accomplish in your time, and then set the world on a course toward future achievements after you've left office.
The CTO of the U.S., Megan Smith, was here a couple of weeks ago, and she talked about her role in urging folks from Silicon Valley, young people with a strong science and technology background, to look at government service and to bring a higher, I think she called it a T quotient, technology quotient, to the federal government. How do you feel about the people you work with in DOE, the level of technical capability and competence? How are we doing in having the intellectual resources we need to deal with all of these issues?
First, I'll say I've been incredibly inspired by the people I've had the privilege of working with throughout my time in government. That was true first when we served at the Department of Defense together, Gloria, the dedication, commitment to mission, people who serve for no glory and who work every day on behalf of our country in our military. And now at the Department of Energy, we have many extraordinary machines in the Department of Energy, all across this lab complex, spallation light sources and the biggest microscopes and all sorts of fantastic gadgets, but actually it's the people who make things happen. And what I've been so struck by is the extraordinary commitment to making a difference that is manifest in what these people get up and do every day to push out the boundaries of knowledge, to advance our understanding of the world, and to bring forward solutions to the benefit of the American people. And so for that, I would say for young people, absolutely find a way to serve. Especially if you come out of the S&T field, if you have had a STEM education, there are huge opportunities to make a difference on things that really will matter to the future of this planet. And we have generational change going on across our lab enterprise where the best people are getting older and we're recruiting a whole new generation of talent. There are big programs to bring in that talent across the lab network. Again, on our website, you can find them. There are summer internships and job openings and possibilities to participate in this great endeavor to keep our country strong and safe. And so I encourage young people to join forces with us because it's a very meaningful career path and where you really feel at the end of the day you've made a difference.
You were using some driving metaphors about driving to Paris and beyond. What about electric vehicles and alternative energy vehicles? What does DOE do to promote the development and commercialization of electric vehicle technology?
So again, at our labs, lots of research has been done on new technologies for electric vehicles. And we also work on the storage part of the equation, on the piece of this that has been an inhibitor to people's choosing to move to electric vehicles. People just don't know if they're going to find a charge where they need it. Can you go at long enough distance to make it reliable to have an electric vehicle? And so our efforts have been focused on doing the research and then deploying it. We put a lot of money into work on lighter weight materials as well. Indeed, some of the cars that are now on the market, both cars and also trucks, benefit from the material science technology work that's been done at our labs and that has then enabled us to support work with the private sector to bring these materials that will make the vehicles lighter, enable the electric vehicles to go more efficiently.
As an electric vehicle driver, one of the barriers now is just being able to find a charge, not because enough people are driving electric vehicles that the charger network is not sufficient. And the Mercury News actually just reported on this about a week ago. It's what we electric vehicle drivers have known from some time. There's this little war that's going on where people take the chargers out of each other's vehicles and a system of leaving notes on windshields and asking people, and your cell phone beeps, you know, and you can tell somebody has just taken the charger out of your car. So what can and should DOE do this is what's happening on the ground, actually. What can DOE do to promote the development of more widespread charger networks?
This is what we're trying to do, is both develop the technology that will make them more widespread, bring costs down, and then work with states to get them deployed. I know you have a discussion underway in the state of California right now on this with the utilities about how to get charging stations out to a wider population so that more people can buy electric vehicles.
Let's shift for just the last couple of minutes to talking about your motivations and your path. You've had an extraordinarily long run in government public service. You have gone in and out of government, but most people who do this go in for a few years and come out. You've gone back for another round from the Clinton to the Obama administration, and then another round in a different department. What has motivated you to this level of public service? And also, knowing you personally, I know it involves a lot of sacrifice. I know your husband, who's here, who practices medicine here in the Bay Area and goes back and forth to Washington as a very incredibly supportive husband. And so there are a lot of family sacrifices and challenges here. What keeps you on this path? What has motivated you?
I think that I am very motivated to work on the world's hardest problems. And that comes from having been brought up in a family where my parents encouraged me and my brother to choose a life in which we would make a difference. And the hardest problems are the ones that have felt to me to be the ones most worth working on. So together, you and I worked to try to persuade three countries to give up their nuclear weapons after the end of the Cold War. And as a result of that, we took thousands of nuclear weapons off the global playing field. That felt like it was worthy of the effort we put into it. And now to have an opportunity to work on another global challenge, to work on preventing climate change, feels equally worth what it takes. And I think that it's important for us not to just talk the talk about making a difference, but walk the walk. And so I get up every morning feeling very privileged to get to serve, to have a chance in an administration that has been as as bold and visionary as this one to put us on a path toward a healthy planet. And I think often, to be honest, Gloria, about the people who serve in our military and who go out every day on the front line and stand sentry for us. And I think if you compare their sacrifice to mine, mine is very small. So I feel very fortunate to get to do this. And as I noted, I think if young people think about service, they should consider all the ways in which at the end of a period of time in which you serve, you can look back and feel you really got a chance to contribute to something that is larger than yourself. That is a very satisfying feeling.
It's time for our last question, and this is going to be a little bit of a difficult one. You went from working on that first problem you talked about, trying to diminish the number of nuclear weapons out there, to the problems related mainly to climate change. Which is the most threatening problem, and what do you feel is the, how do you compare those two missions to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and to, which is more crucial to our future?
Actually, I get to work on both. So one of the amazing things about the Department of Energy, as I noted, is that we have responsibility for our nuclear arsenal and nuclear security programs around the world, and we have responsibility for working on clean energy and climate change. So I don't have to make that difficult choice. And I would also say, truly, people who work in this field generally don't get to choose which threat is harder. Sometimes if you take your eye off one, it's the one that bites you. So what we have to do is keep our eye on a range of threats and work to counter them simultaneously. It's one of the challenges for people in public service today, whether at the local level, the state level, or the federal level. We face a lot of challenges, and it's why public discourse on the issues of the day, like at a Commonwealth Club forum such as this one, are so important, because the American people need to understand how hard these challenges are to meet and what is required to tackle them effectively so that successor generations will benefit from the opportunities that we have had. It doesn't come without hard work and effort and investment, like that investment in infrastructure we need to make, and the American people need to have a greater appreciation of those challenges so that we can move together to solve them.
Please join me in thanking our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, Deputy Secretary of Energy. We thank you not only for being here, but for the service that you're providing. We thank our audiences here on the internet, radio, television. I'm Dr. Gloria Duffy. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the nation's oldest, largest, and most lively public forum, is now adjourned.